agreement, which it turned out he was not authorized to sign by law.
An education agreement?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was not authorized to sign that agreement because the secretary of HEW is not invested by law with the capacity of signing agreements with foreign governments. And to this day, it is a bone of contention because ICA was then the implementing agency for the agreement that he signed. And ICA, even today, wishes for it to be the signator of the educational agreement with the Chinese. It still bureaucratically rankles people.
I didn't know that.
No, I think most people were not too aware of it other than ICA.
Well, that must have been.
But he made a number of agreements, a health agreement.
Yes.
He went off on his own and in a strong fashion. He's a strong-willed individual. Then he insisted on staying in Hawaii on his way back, you remember. I don't know whether you remember. And then he was soon fired. I've been told the president was particularly piqued at his stopping in Hawaii on his way back. For what reason, I do not know.
That was too bad. Because he's a very capable...
Indeed.
Very capable individual. Now, the Hesburgh delegation, this was a delegation that was... An American delegation who was to attend the technology conference in Vienna, and not all the delegations.
Jim Grant was on that one too, I think.
Jim Grant, right. And Hesburgh and the woman were co-chairpersons of the delegation. They met with Foreign Minister Wang Guang and Fong Yi gave a banquet for them. June the 29th, we gave a dinner for Vice Premier Kang Sharan and his party, who were about to depart for the U.S. Then I see my first breakfast with July 3, 1979, with Gilbert Robinson and his party relative to the Chinese trade exhibition. That was my first introduction to that. And it was too bad that really the Chinese did not go to an experienced company that these people, who I think meant well, after they had made the arrangements with the Chinese, then they formed a company to carry out the contract.
Gilbert Robinson is now the number two or three man at ICA.
Number two,
I see.
The deputy in in ICA. He came to China after the exhibition was all over. Christmas time in 1980, and they had lost money, and in particular, there were a large number of small creditors to the tune of, I think, some $400,000 who were just out for their services and goods they had provided. And he came to China to try and convince the Chinese to put up some money, was it Morgan Guaranty that was the chief banker?
I don't remember.
I think it was. Anyway, they were willing to swallow most of the debts. But they wanted some help in this regard. Now, the Chinese, I think, got considerable benefit from that exhibit. It was a great success in certain ways, certainly the one in San Francisco, which I saw. And on which, as I understand it, they did make money. And they lost money in Chicago and a great deal in New York. But there were some additional benefits out of contracts and contacts the Chinese made that were ongoing. And so he came at Christmas time in 1980, and I did not go to the meetings with him. Yes, I went to one meeting. I went to one meeting. And then the subsequent meetings he carried on by himself. Had him, since he was stranded, come to the house on the Christmas dinner along with others, other Americans who were in Peking at that time. Something he's never forgotten, although I'm not exactly on those political lists that he manages. He always writes to me on Christmas time and so on. But eventually, almost a year later, the Chinese did put up enough money so the small creditors were paid off. I think they put up the $400,000, which was the approximate total.
My only contact with this, most of it was handled in the State Department. The call that I received from Gilbert Robinson not too long after this visit of his in July, and he said that Hua Guofeng was coming to the United States to open up the fair. I just picked up the phone, and my secretary, I didn't answer all phone calls. My secretary said, someone is here to tell you Hua Guofeng is coming to the U.S. So I answered the phone. It was Mr. Gilbert Robinson, whom I had met earlier, I think, but under what circumstances, I do not remember. He said, Hua Guofeng is coming to the United States in the fall to open up this trade fair. And I said, and he said, and since that's the case, will Jimmy Carter be there also? And I said, before I say whether President Carter would be there, it comes as some interest to me that Hua Guofeng is coming to the United States. I hadn't known anything about it. He said, yes, he has the commitment, so I then had to take down his name and all of it. He said, I'd try to find out. And I said, I thought if Hua Guofeng was coming, President Carter would consider it seriously. Then we ascertained it was less than a firm commitment that he had from Hua Guofeng.
I think the fact that he asked for it meant to him that that was, since it wasn't flatly refused, that was a commitment.
That was his style.
Ultimately, Bowie Bo went. And the Secretary of Commerce,
the new one, the one from Chicago.
Right.
Philip Klutznik.
But in the event he could not come, because the opening coincided with a Jewish holiday, and the deputy secretary came.
I don't remember who that
was. From North Carolina, who's now head of a Washington bank. Luther Hodges, Jr. Along with Boy Bo, opened the fair, which Then we finally, on the 7th of July, signed the trade agreement.
All right.
Myself and the Foreign Trade Minister,
Lee Chiang.
Then it was expected that shortly thereafter, the Most Favored Nation situation would be put into effect. It was still hanging balance when
Mondale. Well, that's that period that I indicated to you, where we then began to encounter, from the White House perspective, inordinate delays on the other side in sending the thing up. To what extent at this point were you remaining in contact with the American domestic political scene?
Only by casual correspondence with friends.
Mm-hmm. Because in my view, this was the month of June, July were the decisive months that brought on eventually Carter's defeat. There were many factors, obviously, but we now deal with the period in which he went up to Camp David in his retreat, where he invited these numerous wise men of the United States to look at the United States, and the exercise culminated in that speech, which was more praised than damned, in fact, and then soon thereafter, all momentum that he had generated from his speech was dissipated with the simultaneous firing of Blumenthal, Califano, Schlesinger, and the resignation of his first Attorney General, Griffin Bell, and I think there was one other who left. Oh, yes, the transportation, Brock Adams.
Right.
I think it seared in the public's mind a sense that the president, they did not have a competent president.
Of course, the speech, which was well received in the first instance, as you say, with time, began to wear thin. You know, became known as the malaise speech, and I think it was a misreading of the basic problem that the country was facing. And I've read since that there was a deep split at the top of the administration. Mondale was very much opposed to that line being taken.
Elizabeth Drew wrote a very good account of that soon thereafter in the New York Times, based on Mondale leaks. And then there was a piece not too long ago, I guess I'd read.
It's the one not too long ago that...
Where did that appear?
I don't know.
We both had read the same one. New York Sunday Times magazine, maybe something like that.
Probably. I would think it was somewhere in the Times.
But from then on, I think you were representing a president who had damaged himself on the domestic side. The foreign policy side was unknown, but on the domestic side, I think it would be very hard to recover from. And he had alienated a number of people. Califano, another loser in that. And I think it whetted Ted Kennedy's appetite to go after him.
Well, I don't think it whetted Ted's appetite so much as it infuriated all of Ted's supporters.
That's the way to do it.
Got themselves into the position of, by God, you have to go. This man is not a Democrat. He doesn't stand for anything we stand for. He has to be challenged. And later on, I'll come to this, but when I saw Ted Kennedy, I got the very distinct impression of a man who was not particularly happy. this was before the first results came in. This is before Iowa and New Hampshire, but he didn't say I was pushed into this or anything, but also when I was home talking to those who were on the inner circle, that was their attitude. Better a Republican sort of business. This man has to be challenged. I must say that during that summer, I kept saying to Sharon, I think I'm going to be called home. And in view of the close association Carter and I had in the 76 campaign, I thought maybe I'd be asked to come back to work in the White House in a political sense, because it was problems obviously were domestic. Mm-hmm. Political difficulties were domestic. Not entirely certainly, because some things that had gone wrong, badly wrong, in Iran. But much of the foreign policy was doing quite well. The African policy certainly was getting pretty good marks.
We just had the major Iranian debacle, but we had not yet had our prisoners, our embassy seized.
No.
So that was the negative. But all the rest was quite positive.
Had pretty good marks for the Soviet relationship at that particular
That's right.
point.
Salt. I think we should